Cancer Televised Fundraising Special. It is back. It's broadcast on more than 50 broadcast and cable networks across the U.S. and Canada. That includes Bloomberg Television. Here to talk a little bit about it, we welcome Katie Couric, well-known journalist and broadcaster. She's a member of the Stand Up to Cancer Council of Founders and Advisors. She joins us from Los Angeles. Katie, great to have you here with us. 10 years, when you look back, tell us a little bit about this event and where it started and where it's come to today.
Well, hi, Carol and Jason. Nice to talk to you. You know, it's so exciting. We're having our 10th anniversary this year. So in 2008, nine kind of type A women who were really frustrated with the pace of cancer research and the progress or lack thereof that was being made got together and said, you know, we need to do something about this. So we established Stand Up to Cancer. It's now a division of the Entertainment Industry Foundation, which is the philanthropic arm of Hollywood, to really change the paradigm of cancer research. Our emphasis is on collaboration among institutions and companies instead of competition. And our goal is to get treatments to patients at a much faster rate. And, you know, after a decade, we have raised more than $500 million supporting these scientists who are working together, really tackling a whole host of cancers, you know, with a teamwork approach. We call them dream teams. And now we have our efforts have contributed to five new FDA-approved drugs for various cancers, and we just are keeping our gas on the pedal, and we're not letting up because still 8 million people die every year of cancer worldwide, and it's just unacceptable. We're making great progress, but we will not rest until cancer is either treated as a disease that can be managed or cured altogether.
Well, Katie, one of the things that's so interesting, we just had a conversation with a doctor from NYU, and we were talking about the fact that NYU is now going to offer free tuition at its medical school. The economics of this, of sort of the back end of the research, it's fundamentally broken in a lot of places. How do you find those areas, and how do you crack the code to essentially get people on board and out of this sort of siloed mindset? Because that seems to be something you've been successful doing.
Well, you know, I think at first, Jason, some of the scientists were pretty reticent about sharing their intellectual property and their resources and their brains. But, you know, after a very short period of time, I think it really energized their efforts. And, you know, we have a very rigorous review process and a very rigorous selection process led by Phil Sharp, who's a Nobel laureate from MIT, and Marge Fody through the American Association of Cancer Researchers. And, you know, they seem to really enjoy working together. There were two arch competitors when we started, and now they love collaborating so much that their families even take vacations together.
That is
so I think if we try to break down these barriers and silos, they know what they're doing. They all are so dedicated and committed to helping patients, and they know that they leave their egos at the door of their labs, and they know that helping patients is what their research is all about. So it's been surprisingly effortless, I think, for many of them.
Katie, I'm also curious about, there's so much data out there, and I feel like the healthcare industry or community is finally really tapping into it and trying to share it because, you know, you get better outcomes when you have a bigger sampling, if you will, of patients. And I'm just curious what you've seen over this past decade, the use of data and the sharing of that data and how that's helped in terms of improving outcomes for cancer patients.
Well, you know, I think we're actually still just, you know, very much, Carol, on the cusp of really using data to improve outcomes and to help patients select the right treatment for them. I think what's so exciting about this moment in time for cancer research is we've got this convergence of all kinds of expertise, you know, from data scientists to artificial intelligence, to basic biology, to physicists, to engineers, all working together with scientists that will improve the outcomes for patients. So we're starting to see data, I think, have a real impact on cancer, on treatments, and on outcomes. But I still think we have a long way to go, and that's why we really want to continue focusing on this umbrella approach, because Stand Up to Cancer isn't just about scientists. It's about all these people working together and from all these different disciplines.
So, Katie, it would be a dereliction of duty on our part if we had you on the phone and didn't ask you about this moment we're living in as it relates to media and politics. What happens from here, given what we're seeing in the world around the media landscape?
Well, gosh, that's a pretty open-ended question.
I want you to take it wherever you want.
Landscape. I could take that in a lot of ways. Can you get more specific?
Well, what should we be doing? What are you doing as a journalist, in your estimation, to sort of fight the fake news element that's out there, coming from the highest levels?
It's really, really upsetting and depressing. You know, I talked to one of our scientists who's from South Carolina, and I said, how are people feeling? You know, it's a red state, obviously supported President Trump. I said, are they feeling, still supportive of him given everything that is going on and all these revelations? And he said, the tariffs actually were starting to hurt people in South Carolina. But he also said that, that a lot of the things that are reported in the press aren't necessarily believed by people because the moniker of fake news has really penetrated many people in the country. And I think that journalists have to keep doing their jobs and, fight back. I will not even use that term, and I'm sorry I just did, because I think it is so misleading and such a blight on our industry that we really we shouldn't buy into the term itself. And I think we just have to stay strong and keep doing our job, but also start covering other things that matter to Americans.
Yes.
And not just the drama in the White House 24/7, because it happens to be good for ratings.
And like the Stand Up to Cancer broadcast that will be tonight, 8 p.m. Wall Street time. Katie Couric, thank you so much for your time. Member of the Stand Up to Cancer Council of Founders and Advisors on the phone from L.A. So how timely is this, JK? Because I was at a doctor's office, and I love to talk to everybody about, the medical industry. And a couple of folks working there were pre-med students. And they brought up this thing about NYU making news, obviously, when it announced it would offer full tuition scholarships for medical students. It became, I guess, the first top-ranked medical school to do just that. So I thought it was fascinating because we were talking about the cost and so on and so forth. Let's continue this conversation, because back in our studio, here in our New York studio, is Dr. Ian Lusbader. He's Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center. Whoa, this is a big deal.
It is a big deal. NYU really broke ground with this. Thanks for having me, by the way. Nice
to
see you guys.
Nice to have you here.
Jason and Carol, all very cozy. It is unique. It took a lot of funding. We certainly believe that further career choice may be affected by high tuitions and huge debt. 75% of medical students graduate with sizable debt, hundreds of thousands of dollars.
But they can also make a lot of money afterwards.
Right.
Can they
It takes a long time to get there.
I'm going to play devil's advocate a little bit. But, my gut was like, so why not to teachers or social workers or other things that are not going to make a lot of money?
That argument has been raised. Like, why should we support this group? We know college education is very expensive. Engineers and so forth are important. We are going to reach a crisis. We have an aging population. Primary care specialties are seen much less as desirable. More paperwork, more headaches, more medication approvals, CAT scan approvals. Young people in debt, we believe, and by surveys show, they don't want to go through the hassle of 24/7 on call. They want shift work in the emergency room or dermatology or radiology. They want a better lifestyle.
Yeah.
And so in order to encourage students to do what we're going to need, we think somewhere between 30 and 50,000 physicians are going to be needed by 2030 for an aging population and to really coordinate all this specialty care. Individual patients can't say, I need a cardiac cath or I need a colonoscopy.
Do we have a shortage of doctors?
It appears that we are coming to that point. There are more retiring, probably not only because of age. There's a bubble of boomers that are retiring. Part of that may be the hassles in medicine that people are saying, I can get out, I'm going to get out. In the old days, physicians would work to, 70, 80 plus.
Yeah. One of the things I found interesting about this, too, is obviously in order to do this, you need to raise money in order to make it happen. You know, New York is a place where, let's just be honest, there are a lot of rich guys' names on a lot of buildings, and they have paid for unbelievable facilities. This is an investment in people, which we haven't seen as much.
It is unique, and we do know Roy Vagelos up at Columbia, certainly Ken Langone, Jan Vilcek, Larry Fink at NYU, other institutions. Do have heavy hitters. That's not true all across the country.
Right.
I mean, David Geffen School, you know, you can go on and on and on. And there are some questions. Should the government, as in other countries, have graduate education for areas that are needed, like physicians? Should they step in? It's a debate. Certainly with our debt now, it's unlikely that's going to happen. So private donors who believe in bettering the world have stepped up.
And so as you talk to your colleagues around the country, do you get the sense that this idea may catch on? Do other places have the pool, to your point, of donors or other sorts of philanthropy to tap to offer these same sorts of opportunities?
So NYU raised somewhere in the area of $600 million. It's a huge number. Many institutions can't really do that. I think they'll be motivated to do that. Part of it is you can attract really the best students, guide them into higher areas. Internal medicine can be encouraged and primary care. No, I don't think every institution can do it, and that's why some people raise the question, should government somehow step in, make loans go away for those who choose the specialties you think you need?
So I do wonder if that's part of it, too. The thinking is that because of the debt load for someone who is a medical student, that they might tend to go into the medical profession where it's higher paying, a different route versus others.
So
I wondered if that was I'm just curious.
Oh, that's absolutely part of the thinking.
Yeah.
We don't really have outcomes data, right? This just started. We'll know in X number of years, does free tuition or full tuition scholarship, will that raise the number of people in primary care? I think it will.
Does somebody go to a rural area where there is no medical care and maybe help out?
So that's another question. How do you encourage better distribution, not just the specialty, but where they go? At least this is a topic of conversation. It's an important need, and we will have a dearth of doctors coming up in the next couple of decades. We need to address it now before there's a real crisis.
Why not reduce the cost of it? You know what I mean? What does it cost to go to? Is it
whether it's undergraduate education? Right, they raise that 3% every year.
But medical school, it's.
So the real question is, what does it cost? Can that be reduced? I think that's a fair question. I think we have to look into that.
Yeah. And not just medical school. We've had this conversation about
College tuition, graduate
overall.
School tuition.
You do wonder if this moves into a broader conversation around the cost of undergraduate or certainly the cost of some of the more professional and specialized areas. Dr. Ian Lesbader, Clinical Associate Professor of Medicine at NYU.
The long and winding road.
Well, it certainly has been a winding road over the past few months for Tesla and for its founder and CEO, Elon Musk. A lot of headlines just this week and certainly today, not the least of which was Mr. Musk's appearance last night on a podcast. And then following that this morning, the departure of two top executives. To help us dig into that a bit, Ross Gerber, President and Chief Executive Officer of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. He joins us on the phone from Santa Monica. And Ivan Feinseth, Managing Director and Chief Investment Officer at Tigress Financial Partners, joining us on the phone from New York City. So, Ross, I want to start with you. You are a probably self-described, I would imagine, Tesla bull. You were with us not too long ago, last month, talking about the go private proposal. What do you make of the news of late?
Well, it seems like this accounting professional was sort of an expert at going private and was probably brought in specifically for that. And I can only imagine his frustration after the last month to then have Elon go into the board and say, forget about it. And so he left. And And I get that. It's been a really tough month at Tesla, you know, as well as for shareholders. So I wouldn't think too much about a guy who's been there for 3 or 4 weeks. And
Ross.
What, you think it's a big deal?
Come on. They have lost a lot of individuals, senior executives at a time.
Yeah.
Come on.
It's a stressful place to work, and it's definitely not for many, many people. I would say the same thing about my company.
Huh. All right, Ivan, come on in on this.
I feel that Elon likes to take his Model 3 now that he's driving on a detour into Crazy Town on a regular basis.
Yeah, totally. And you know what?
But why don't you have a sell rating then, Ivan? You've got a neutral. Why not just say, forget it, folks, I'm out of here.
Ross makes a lot of good points. And I am neutral on the stock, so I'm not a bull on the stock, but I am a fan of the car and the company and the man himself, separate from what has just happened recently.
We talked
you
to
have
some...
to admire the success of starting a automobile company from scratch, which is very different than starting any other type of technology company in Silicon Valley, and making a world-class car that is so admired the way the car is and has been such a game changer. But I think the main issue is that Elon Musk has never evolved from an entrepreneur into a CEO. He's still an entrepreneur.
So is it just a case that they need kind of a grown-up in the room, Ross?
Yeah, I totally think so, and I've been saying this for some time. I really think it's the board's responsibility to build a team around him. I mean, he's not really able to do that on his own, because I do agree that he's an entrepreneur, and he is a great businessman. You know, he's built two companies into worth tens of billions of dollars, so I don't want to, you know, just like say, oh, he's not a good businessman. But, like, there's no question that it's not clear on a succession plan. I mean, God forbid he got sick or a Steve Jobs thing happened. You know, people forget Steve Jobs lied to everybody, lied to the shareholders. He was dying, didn't get treatment, lied about it, and then comes in and says, I'm dying. So, you know, keep things in perspective here. But
yeah, but Apple was making a ton of money.
It doesn't matter. It was a horrible time. I was an Apple shareholder. Everybody told me to sell Apple because Tim wasn't going to be able to do it, and we didn't. But my question is if something happened to Elon, who's there, Tim Cook? And they don't have that. And as a shareholder, that's my biggest concern. I don't really care about, you know, an accountant who didn't like working at Tesla. I care about the fact that there isn't a deep enough bench if adversity struck or just as a corporation. I do think they have an obligation to their shareholders, and the board has this obligation to surround him with some very solid kind of people.
Well, and that's a really interesting point, and that goes back to something Carol asked you about at the top, Ross, in terms of this sort of these executives not being able, you know, in your estimation, to hang with the culture. Ivan, I put that question to you. How worried are you rating this stock that there isn't that bench, and how likely is it that that's going to get changed in the near term from what you know?
I think that the recent events that started with the take private text and the events yesterday are now going to accelerate the board building a stronger bench. I think that has been a concern, but when the company has been successful in the production of the car. It hasn't met all of its production targets, and it's not yet profitable, even though Elon says it's going to be by the end of the year. The board, I think, needs tighter controls, and they need more structure, it seems, to their management team. But I'm still just shocked that Elon, as brilliant as he is and as successful as he has been, still acts this way. I mean, that is a concern, no matter how deep the bench is.
Well, it implies that he's acting differently than he's ever acted. I think it's just that everybody's criticizing him now for the way he's acting, when before, when everything's going great, everybody thinks it's fine. So I think it's...
Well, Ross, don't you concede, though, it's gone to a different level a little bit? I mean, to come out and say, I've got the money to take the company private, when it seems like he really clearly hadn't had it all set up. I mean, these are not things you do as a CEO of a publicly held company.
I don't think we know the truth yet of how all that went down, so I don't want to make any, like, oh, this is what happened. There's no question that he shouldn't have tweeted any deal before it was done.
And okay? Let me just throw in this, because the Tesla headline crossing the Bloomberg, it's naming an individual, promoting them to the vice president of people and places. And I guess the guy who is president of automotive, is it a guy or a girl? I'm not quite sure of this headline. But it looks like they are naming people to the positions that were opened up and that people
Jerome
left.
Jerome Guillen has been promoted to president of automotive.
Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, and they have clearly another one some things happening. To, like Kevin Kassekert has been promoted to VP of People and Places, giving him responsibility for human resources.
So, okay, Ivan, what do we need to see from Tesla? I don't know. How much time do we give them in the next couple of weeks, just quickly?
As far as replacing people or?
Well, what do you want to see in terms of strategy at the company? Is it just, is it the board get new people in, new CEO, just quickly?
I don't think it would be good to replace him as CEO. Okay. I think, though, they need some, a COO position, an operating position. A strong, experienced automotive operator would be good.
Yeah, I agree 100% with that.
Right, and they just named Chris Lister vice president of the Gigafactory operation. So it sounds like they're doing a lot of things in the executive suite. Ross Gerber, thank you so much. President and CEO at Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management, a shareholder in Tesla, and Ivan Feinseth, managing director, chief investment officer at Tigress Financial Partners. We're going to be talking about Tesla next week. I, you know it, Jason.
You know it. It's Bloomberg Business Week.